Hey folks, welcome back to Pearls and Perspectives. I'm Dr. Amy Pearlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health. And today's episode is a big one. I have the honor of sitting down with Dr. John Mulhall, who truly needs no introduction in the world of men's health, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He's the director of male sexual and reproductive medicine at Memorial Sloan Kettering. He's a global authority on sexual dysfunction and testosterone deficiency, and his research has really shaped how we treat men, period. He's a co-author on the AUA guidelines for testosterone deficiency and certainly a force when it comes to educating the next generation of sexual medicine providers. Dr. Mulhall, welcome to today's episode.
It's my pleasure to be here, Amy.
So I'm excited for today. You know, I think we initially met, you know, at different meetings. We kind of maybe said hello here and there, both on, at the time, the board of the Sexual Medicine Society of North America. And we're going to flip the script today because oftentimes you're the question asker and I'm going to ask you the questions today.
I'm looking forward to it.
And we're going to focus on testosterone. And so we're going to assume for this, because most of our listeners are urologists, so we're going to assume that most people watching know the basics of testosterone. All right. So we're going to kick it off from there. So when it comes to your approach, and I know you're a co-author on the guidelines, so we can definitely talk about the evidence and the guidelines, but I really want to pick your brain today. So in terms of your approach, when are you checking total versus free testosterone in the clinic?
Yeah. So I think that obviously if somebody comes in with a lot of symptoms, then we're going to check them, the T levels. I'll talk about what those T levels are in a minute. But there are other indications. So if somebody has a history of chemotherapy, if somebody has a history of pituitary surgery, if somebody has testicular atrophy, a history of HIV, or other comorbidities that are classically associated with low T, for example, we do this routinely now in diabetics, then we check T levels. There's a lot of interest in whether men with varicocele should have T levels done. The literature is not very supportive, although it's not very extensive. But we do check T levels in men with high grade, grade 2 and grade 3 varicoceles. And we check a total and free testosterone level at baseline. Now, it's very interesting to me that most urologists don't know what lab assay is being used at their hospital or at the facility they use, Quest or LabCorp, for example. We insist on LC-MS for total, and we insist on equilibrium dialysis for free. And that's largely because their coefficient of variations is very low. It's about 7% compared to the 15 to 30% that you get with amino assays for both assays. So for both free and total T. So we insist on those. And that's our basic screen. In patients who have high risk for having very low T levels, testicular volumes of 8 mLs bilaterally, for example, post, let's say, a testis cancer person, orchiectomy, 4 cycles of EDP, right? We know their T level is going to be low. And so we get a more broad panel. Total and free up front, if they're low, and we can talk about what that means in a minute, then we repeat with total and free, SHBG, LH level, a hematocrit, if they're 40 years of age or older, a PSA, and we check a prolactin, and we check a hemoglobin A1C. If I'm concerned that they really have low T levels, then we'll also get a bone densitometry. Okay? And I use HbA1c elevation and bone density abnormalities as surrogate markers of T levels being low for that patient. So even if their T level don't meet the AUA guidelines, let's say their T level is 380, but they're highly symptomatic, if they have bone density loss and if they have elevated hemoglobin A1c, to me, that means that that T level is low for that person.
I love that because you're really honing in on the signs rather than always the symptoms. And we talk about signs and symptoms, but I don't know that we really discuss the signs or how to measure the signs in clinical practice. Right. And I know the DEXA scan, you know, that's in our guidelines, but I don't remember the last time I got a DEXA. With that being said, there's a recent guy that I saw who used to be an endurance athlete who has low testosterone. And I said, would you like a DEXA scan?
Yeah, so I use it primarily as a surrogate marker, right? And I think, for example, if you have somebody who's got a lot of symptoms and their level is 390 and, you know, 300 being the reasonable cutoff from the guidelines, but they're very symptomatic and their levels are 390 and their free level's okay, If they've normal bone density, normal hemoglobin A1C, and a normal hematocrit, then there's an argument against them getting T. Now, remember, and you pointed out very well, the symptomatology is ridiculously nonspecific. If you take questionnaires like Adam, Q Adam, Andro test, and the AG Mail survey, outside of the validation studies, they've said specificity levels of 25%. So if you're positive on your questionnaire, you have a 1 in 4 chance of having low T. So the symptoms are nonspecific, and there's symptoms of chronic stress, chronic fatigue, obstructive sleep apnea, maybe even chronic nocturia. People are exhausted during the day, right? So I don't hang my hat on the symptoms. I pay attention. If somebody has all or nearly all of the symptoms, low energy, afternoon fatigue, decreased strength, decreased endurance, losing muscle, putting on fat centrally, irritability, depression, decreased response to exercise, decreased productivity at work, if they have most of those, then I'm paying attention. Now, you notice there that I didn't mention erectile dysfunction or low libido. And I don't think libido is a great marker of low sex drive, right? Of low T. I don't think that low libido is a great marker of low T levels. Why? Because 10% of the patients in my practice on ADT have preservation of visceral sex drive. Mm-hmm. They see an erotic stimulus, they think of an erotic stimulus, and they're aroused and they want to have sex. So there are some patients for whom T is not the most important thing when it comes to libido. And from an erectile function standpoint, there are a million causes of ED. And low T is way down on the list. And if you give somebody T, the guidelines show this, the randomized controlled trial, systematic review, they actually improve people's erectile function in quite a minimal effect. Statistically significantly, but not clinically meaningful changes in erectile function. So I'm a big sign fan. Bone density, hemoglobin A1C, and actually even unexplained anemia, right? Muscle loss. Somebody comes in and says, listen, I'm losing muscle, okay? These are important things to me. From a symptom standpoint, the European Male Aging Study will say that low libido, erectile function are very important. I've just told you I disagree with that. So big sign fan in my practice. And ultimately, people with low T levels below 200, for example, they're at risk for bone sugar heart problems, right? Osteoporosis, elevated hemoglobin A1C, prediabetes development, and premature cardiovascular events. And the Molly Shores data from the VA, albeit an old data set now, would suggest that men with T levels below 200 nanograms per deciliter are at increased risk for premature death, largely related to cardiovascular events. So I am constantly having bone sugar heart discussions, especially in our ADT patients.
Gosh, that's so fascinating. I have so many follow-up questions I want to ask you about this. And I think one of them is the overwhelming nature that is Quest and LabCorp when we go to put in the order for a laboratory test. There are so many options that pull up. And I don't really remember too often in medicine where we look through all those options and we say, what do you order when you want to see the value for this test? And that goes for whether it's vitamin D or whatever it is. And it matters so much. So I've started telling my colleagues, if I have another, like a referring provider where the person's going to go to that person's clinic and order labs, I specifically tell them to order these assays because every time that I haven't done that, they've ordered the wrong ones.
Yeah. Yeah. And listen, in fairness to Quest and LabCorp, they do equilibrium dialysis. Mm-hmm. The beauty of equilibrium dialysis, without getting too far into the weeds, is that it's supposed to be calibrated with great regularity. So if you look at the reference ranges, you'll see they change. Every couple of days or every few days, they change. The problem with doing that at Quest and LabCorp, and I've spoken to their medical directors, okay, is that they give you a standard reference range. So I don't know. It'll usually be 5 to 20. Our reference rate, some days it's 3 to 14. Some days it's 6 to 22. Okay? And that's because it's being recalibrated. But I feel very strongly that if you're going to do T levels, that we want to get accurate levels. Okay? And I constantly see people coming in who've got an immune assay and their T level's 290. And when it's repeated using LCMS, their total T level is either 190 or 390. And so this is important. And it's, as I said earlier on, it's very impressive to me when I speak and I give tea talks, how many people in the audience have no idea what assay their lab is using.
I was recently listening to a podcast and it was like two medicine providers recapping their interview with a hormone specialist. And they were saying that the hormone specialist doesn't treat men with low T who have reversible causes, of their testosterone being low. And they'll check the labs like first thing in the morning, which our AUA guidelines support, right? Because if you check it in the afternoon, it could be lower. But are we missing an opportunity to help people? Are we looking for reasons not to treat someone who might have symptoms of low T?
I think in the urology space, the answer to that question is most probably no. I think outside of urologists, I think there remains still grave concern about the safety of testosterone therapy. I think the TRAVERSE data that's come out now, it's over a year old, shows very clearly that T therapy is not linked to increased risk of major adverse cardiovascular events. That's 5,200 men or so, randomized controlled trial. And there is no increased risk of prostate events. So I think those major concerns should be assuaged now. The FDA, of course, have committed to changing the label about MACE. I don't believe it's happened yet. I'm hoping the AUA will change the guideline statement that talks about MACE. So I think, yes, there is a discomfort in among non-urologists. I think going back to your point about reversible causes, there really aren't that many reversible causes. So we'll take obesity, for example. It's very common that I see a man coming in, he's diabetic, he's got low T, and he's got central obesity, and he's seen his PCP, or he's seen an endocrinologist, and they'll say, we want you to lose weight, Mr. Jones, right? Now, I don't know if you've ever had somebody who's got a T level of 220 or 250. Getting them to lose weight, no matter what their motivation level is very difficult. Because low T, lose muscle, put on fat. So my philosophy in the obese patient is, if you meet the criteria for testosterone deficiency, we're going to put you on T, and maybe in the future, if we can have you lose weight and tighten up your diabetes control, maybe we can get you off T in the long term. In that specific population, you want to be very careful about putting those men on exogenous T, which might suppress their HPG axis. And if they're on it for a year or longer, they may end up getting testicular atrophy that might be irreversible. So I'm a big fan of the alternative T therapy in those patients who are going to lose weight and see if we can get you off medicine in the future. But this idea that you're going to lose weight and you're A, if it even is possible, but that it's going to change your T level alone, is actually flawed. If you look at the AUA...
First of all, I'm so glad that you said that. I'm so glad that you said that because that's what I see in clinical practice. Sorry, continue.
But the if you look at the AUA guidelines and the systematic review meta-analysis of the literature, the only people with meaningful, clinically meaningful changes in their T levels were those patients who underwent bariatric surgery. But there is a guideline statement in there saying you should address modifiable lifestyle factors. To me, okay, if you can get the man to lose weight, you set a very predefined time, 3 months, no significant improvement, move on. Some of these men are left 12, 18 months. And of course, their T level's low, so they're not motivated to go to the gym, right? They're making fat and they're losing muscle anyway. So I'm a big fan. Get people on T, right? With a view to trying to get them off it if we think they're going to be able to lose weight. And the big thing, of course, is hemoglobin A1C control. Okay, and of course, with the advent of GLP-1 receptor agonist and GIP agonist, that's increasingly more likely, and that's a very exciting area of research for the future. Are those drugs alone going to change people's T levels as opposed to having to put people on T therapy? So this idea of functional hypogonadism, where if they don't have a pituitary lesion or they don't have a gross testicular atrophy, we shouldn't be treating them, I think is incredibly flawed. I think, yes, there's a drop in T level as we age. And, you know, if you say to me that we're putting people on medications to help them be active at 75 years of age because they got hip pain, then why wouldn't we do the same to men who have low T and are functionally impaired in their life?
I love the passion coming out of your voice right now. And I'm so glad you brought up this concept of weight loss and what we would expect with testosterone levels, because I see this all the time in my shared clinical practice with my sister. She puts all these patients on GLP-1s. She checks their baseline testosterone. She'll follow up their testosterone levels and they're not going up and they're losing muscle. And what are we going to do? Wait for them to get to their goal weight on the GLP-1 before we do something about it? I can tell exactly when I intervene on these patients because we measure their muscle mass every month and their muscle is either staying stable as they're losing weight or they're losing muscle. All of a sudden, they're gaining muscle. It is a picture speaks 1,000 words. It is the most beautiful picture I've ever seen to see the muscle go up.
For the practicing urologist who almost certainly has ADT patients in their practice, right? it's incredible for me to see. So I see a ton of patients who are on ADT. The level of frailty in these men is unbelievable. If you look at quadriceps muscle strength and the ability for an older man on ADT to get from a sitting to a standing position in an unassisted fashion, you'll be very struck by how poor that is. Now that's frailty, and now they're on ADT, and they're a high risk for low bone density and low trauma bone fractures. Now you got frailty, osteopenia, osteoporosis. They're a setup for low trauma bone fracture, and of course, hip fractures in 70-year-old men is a devastating problem. And I think as men's health experts, these are the things that we want to be paying peripheral attention to. We don't have to manage them. But one of the ways to manage patients with frailty and low T, let's say outside of the ADT population, is testosterone therapy. And I think it's a very reasonable approach in men who have muscle sarcopenia, who have bone density loss, and documented low T.
So let's go back to these patients who are on ADT. Are we doing enough to help them prevent frailty?
So, you know, it's so interesting to me that I work at a very famous cancer center. And I'm not saying the medical oncologists or the radoncs are not having the conversation. I know they are. But patients, when they go in to see these oncologists, are in the cancer mode, right? And they're not listening to a lot of the messaging. They just want their PSA to be controlled. And so this bone sugar heart discussion, I routinely have with my patients. You're at increased risk while on ADT for bone density loss, elevated hemoglobin A1C, and development of major adverse cardiovascular events. The duration of ADT is critical. I don't do prostate cancer for a living, so I'm never going to intervene or opine in that regard. But I do challenge our patients to go to the oncs and say, what's the survival benefit to 6 months versus 24 months? And to me, in the shared decision-making model, the patient should receive information about 5-year biochemical free recurrence rates for 24 months versus 5 years. And the patient makes the decision, do they want 24 months or not? Okay. I think there's incredible parentalism in medicine where I'm the doctor, I know, and this is what you should do. When to me, the discussion should be, here's the data on 24 months of ADT. Here's the data on 6 months of ADT in association with your radiation therapy. What do you want to do? And that almost never happens. But certainly, if you look at the data and men are on ADT for 18 months, 10% of them are left castrate in long term, and 30% never get back to normal. So I think there's a gross undereducation of our patients on ADT. So from a bone standpoint, I insist on everyone getting a baseline bone densitometry and that be followed every 2 years. Right? From a sugar standpoint, I say, listen, you need to be measuring your hemoglobin A1C every 3 months. And from a cardiovascular standpoint, I strongly encourage them to go see a nutritionist and get a higher protein, lower carb diet, because men frequently carb crave when they've no T. And then exercise, all right? It doesn't have to be dramatic exercise, but a little bit of cardio 3 times a week, a little bit of body weight exercising, good for your bones, good for your muscles, good for your blood vessels, and good for your mental health. And so I participate in that discussion. Many urologists may not have the time to do that, but maybe their APP has the time to do that. And I think that's incredibly important messaging for men's health.
Absolutely. I don't think a lot of these patients know what their actual risk is of a major event or a fall.
I think you're correct. Yeah. And listen, I think that we're doing a better job in the modern era post-prostatectomy with patient education. And I think our radoncs and medoncs are lagging a little bit behind this. I'm hoping they will catch up in the future. Okay. Particularly with the ISSM Movember guidelines, I think, which are excellent in this regard. And that we're going to be educating oncologists so that they're not obsessively oncocentric and be focused on PSA only.
So two follow-up questions here. One is, do you think patients want to know this information? Or because I know oftentimes when we say, oh, let's talk about lifestyle with our patients, you know, eat better, exercise more. And I've actually had the experience where I think patients want to know, like, very discreet information. How much protein should I eat? What types of protein? But I think a lot of our colleagues might say, look, we tell our patients this, they're not going to make any changes. Do your patients care?
So I think it's a very interesting question. I think the patients are very PSA-centric early on, right? So you got a de novo prostate cancer patient who's making a decision about definitive therapy, or you got a patient who needs adjuvant or salvage therapy because they got PSA rise after prostatectomy, right? So their focus is on their cancer. Our job, however, is to educate those men about the implications of their decisions. Right. And so there's a time sensitivity to this. There is accumulating evidence that the timing of rehab post prostatectomy may be important. The longer the duration of ADT, the longer it takes a man to have testosterone recovery. We know that's a real problem. Right. So my phrase to my patients is, and my patients are listening, they'll tell you, I remember him telling me this. It's important to me that you understand what I want you to do, the rehab concept. Right? Or the nutrition concept or the exercise concept, why I want you to do it and the implications of not doing it. Mm. Right? So I learned in my first 2 years in practice that if I wasn't explicit and didn't explain the implications of not doing what I suggested, people will come back and say, but you never made it clear to me that I didn't do rehab or I didn't ask my oncologist about the duration of ADT. So it's very important that we point out the implications. Right? So that patients don't come back 2 years later and say, okay, now I'm ready post triple therapy, prostatectomy, radiation, hormone therapy. And 90% of those men have structural changes in their penis, collagenization of their smooth muscle and venous leak. So this is really important to communicate to patients. Some patients are just want to get rid of their cancer, but it's incumbent upon us, I believe, in talking about implications of not pursuing these strategies.
Wow, that's really powerful. Because we don't have that discussion enough. That is 100% certain. So let's go back. Okay, this patient, let's say he's on ADT for 18 months and sees you maybe a year later, right? His PSA is fine, doesn't have recurrence. But his testosterone hasn't recovered. Are you going to use any alternative therapies or exogenous testosterone in this guy?
So first of all, now we're talking about the TPSA concept, right? So we need T to make PSA. If your T level is below saturation point, and that's variably defined as somewhere between 200 and 250, and even that's probably not very accurate. But let's say in our practice we use 200, right? If your T level is below 200, your PSA level, even at the time of diagnosis, but let's say post-prostatectomy or post-radiation ADT, if your PSA is undetectable, that may be a false reading. Because if you don't have enough T, you may be inefficient in your ability to generate PSA. Okay. So in men who T levels below saturation, below 200, I say, listen, your post prostatectomy, your post RT ADT, your PSA is undetectable, but I don't really know what your PSA is. And so we typically do what's called an intramuscular challenge. I didn't invent this. Paul Lang is the first person who talked about this 25 years ago. And we give people an intramuscular T challenge in the office and we see what happens with their PSA. If their PSA goes up over a week, then we say, listen, this is an oncology discussion. Mm. If their PSA doesn't, then we say, I think you're a candidate for T therapy. Okay.
And you would see it after a single IM injection.
That's an excellent question. So the answer to that question is almost certainly never. So we have 150 patients now, 70-something post-prostatectomy, 70-something post-radiation. And we've had very few immediate PSA changes. And when their PSA changes, if it's going to happen, it typically doesn't happen for 6 to 12 months. So we're moving away from this IMT challenge where we're just putting people on T now and following their PSA levels every month for 3 months, every 3 months for a year, and then 6 monthly after that. Okay? But the point is for the urologist that if a man's PSA is below 200, he may not have enough T to generate PSA. And this is really interesting when let's say you have a prostatectomy patient and you put them on T therapy and they're on T therapy for 4 years and all of a sudden their PSA starts to rise. The Gleason 4+3 extra capsule extension. So you're kind of anticipating they're going to have a PSA rise in the future. And now their PSA is going up. Should we stop their T? Right? Because to me, if you're going to use PSA as a metric to investigate patients or to treat patients, wouldn't you want that patient testosterone replete? We have some oncologists at MSK saying, oh, stop the T. And then you stop the T drops below 200, and their PSA becomes undetectable. How are you using that PSA to define what you're going to do with that patient who's got a PSA recurrence? And this is a really interesting concept. And then the final thing is, why are we measuring PSA levels and not indexing it to testosterone levels? Mm-hmm. especially if somebody has a PSA level that's not commensurate with what you think the PSA level should be. So for example, a chap has prostate cancer. He's got a Gleason 3+4 on biopsy, but his PSA level is 1.2. 50% of those men have low T, 30% have T below 200. That's the Memorial data, Jose Flores' paper from a few years ago, right? So, and then men who are 65 years of age and have a 80 gram prostate, right? And the PSA is 1. Shouldn't we be checking T levels? So it's a massive culture shift in the field. But I think that in patients whose PSA level is not commensurate to prostate size or their prostate status, prostate cancer presence, we should be checking T in those patients. And I think there are tons of people walking around in the community who've got normal PSAs, mm-hmm. whose PSA is completely normal only because their T level's low. And if you remember Abe Morgan Taylor's data, JAMA 1999, where they took men with PSA levels below 4 who had low T, 14% of them had prostate cancer in there. And there is an association between low T and higher grade, higher stage prostate cancer, possibly related to a delay in diagnosis because their T level was low. So all of these are relatively new concepts, and to get our oncology friends shifting is a massive cultural effort. But that's my goal over the next decade, to really change the field.
Gosh, it really takes a megaphone. So you bet I'm going to clip this part out of this podcast. I'm going to blast it everywhere.
I look forward to our oncology friends' feedback.
So here's a follow-up question based on what you just said. Let's say you see a guy, you have on testosterone for low T, and then his PSA goes up, and now he's going down the elevated PSA sort of rabbit hole of that whole evaluation. He gets a biopsy. It shows intermediate, you know, risk prostate cancer. And then let's say his radical prostatectomy is scheduled 3 months into the future.
Yeah.
What are you doing with his testosterone therapy leading up until surgery? Are you keeping, when are you restarting it, or are you ever stopping it?
So I want to be very respectful of my oncology colleagues' attitudes and decisions. And so we don't force that. Most of those patients at NSK will not be put on T until after their prostatectomy. But post-prostatectomy, we will have that conversation, if their PSA is undetectable, 12 weeks after surgery. So it's a very interesting question, right? There are three comorbidities that portend a very poor prognosis for erectile function recovery after radical prostatectomy. Diabetes, obstructive sleep apnea, and the presence of very low T levels below 200. So another culture shift would be to say to our prostatectomist, why don't we put off this man's prostatectomy for his Gleason 3+4 organ-confined cancer based on his MRI until such time as his diabetes, his OSA, and his T is optimized, right? Now, the importance of T in the periprostatectomy patient is that T is a neuromodulator. So if you look at the basic science literature and you look at neurite outgrowth from the major pelvic ganglia, there's a robust literature to show that T is a neuromodulator. So if you've low T, no matter how good your nerve sparing is, you may actually be hurting that patient. And if you've very low T, so men who get neoadjuvant ADT, their erectile function outcomes are equivalent to men who've had non-nerve sparing radical prostatectomy, no matter what the nerve sparing status is. So I think conceptually it would be ideal to manage people's T, their diabetes and OSA before, but I think it's going to take a little while for us to convince our prostatectomy colleagues that that's an ideal thing to do. I'm not talking about the 4+4, a high volume ECE on MRI patient who, okay, there's an urgency to doing their prostatectomy. But when oncologically say, I do see a value in us looking at modulation of host factors to optimize erectile function recovery.
Yeah, I recently went to a conference and there were probably 5 people up on stage, and I asked the question, so what would you do in this same patient scenario? And you ask 5 different experts and you get 5 different responses. And when I've spoken to Dr. Morgenthaler about this and Dr. Lipschultz, it's like they want their patients to be anabolic as they're going into surgery to help with recovery. I saw a recent patient in this exact same scenario. I spoke with the urologic oncologist. He was completely fine with me keeping him on his testosterone through therapy. This guy had sex like 2 weeks out from surgery. I didn't give him permission to do that. I thought that was like a little bit too soon. But he was like, Amy, I'm getting great erections post-surgery. I just had sex with my wife. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Well, first of all, hats off to the prostatectomist. Clearly, there's been excellent nurse steering.
Yes.
Usually in a younger man with good, robust baseline erectile function. But just a point on that, of course, the low point post-prostatectomy is 4 months, right? So we've got many men who are an 8 on a 10-point hardness gate at 6 weeks who at 4 months are below penetration hardness. So just a nadir for the prostatectomist. If you have somebody who's functioning well, let's say at 4 or 6 weeks after surgery, they have a 40% chance of any drop and a 25% chance of going to low penetration hardness. So just bear that in mind. But no, listen, I think that is the ideal way to approach patients. But I always look for permission from the oncologist because we want to be collaborative for us to be able to do that. But we will give our patients TE therapy starting 12 weeks after radical prostatectomy, right? If you go to a conference and you say in the audience, what time will you do that? Routinely, people are saying, oh, 1 year. If you believe in a saturation model, then why are you waiting a year, right? If somebody has an undetectable PSA at 12 weeks, then we just treat them with T and we monitor them. And we published in the Journal of Urology in January our organ-confined, low to intermediate-grade prostate cancer data, a couple of hundred patients on T, no increased risk of biochemical recurrence compared to our historical controls. So I think in that population in particular, most of our prostatectomists now are increasingly comfortable using T. Active surveillance and organ-confined prostate cancer, low to intermediate grade for sure.
What about guys who undergo focal therapy for prostate cancer?
Yeah. So from an erectile function recovery standpoint, we rehab them like we do our prostatectomy patients, right? And from a T standpoint, to me, they're basically active surveillance patients, right? So they have a prostate in place. Prostate cancer is multifocal. Hemigland ablation. You know, you're monitoring their PSAs. We just monitor them like an active surveillance patient. When we look at our active surveillance patients, this is not yet published, but manuscript in preparation kind of thing. When we look at the active surveillance patients on TE, almost 50% have a drop in their PSA, a meaningful drop in their PSA over the course of 12 to 18 months after starting TE therapy, which is fascinating.
How did that happen?
The TPSA dynamic, right? Right. I don't know how it happens, but of course you could extrapolate from Sam Denmead's data from Hopkins about giving people high levels of T and the drop in PSA, that bipolar androgen therapy concept.
It is so fascinating how our thought and management on the relationship between T and PSA has changed really over the last 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, and a hats off, of course, to Aid Morgan Taylor for introducing the saturation model to the field and for championing that early on when, you know, he took a lot of abuse early on. But I think he's been vindicated now, and we're very supportive of that, and we're very T-friendly in our prostate cancer population, even in men with high-risk disease. So this is not yet published. So I'll say this coarsely, though I presented it many times now over the course of the last 18 months. If you take men with high-risk prostate cancer, so Gleason 6 or 7 with unfavorable pathology, or Gleason 8, 9, and 10 with any form of pathology, and you put them on T therapy, there is no signal at this point in time comparing men with high-risk disease who have normal T, who don't go on T therapy, men with high-risk disease, low T, who decide not to pursue T therapy, and then with low T, high-risk disease, who go on T therapy, no significant increased risk of biochemical recurrence following those men for 4 years. In fact, if we look at our data, there's a signal that the biochemical recurrence rates are lower in those men getting T therapy. Now, it occurs earlier, right? Giving T, you can mount a PSA response, so we pick up your recurrence earlier. But the rates are no higher in those patients, even in high-risk disease. Not yet published, so not yet peer-reviewed, but being presented many times. Lots of feedback from oncologists and sex med and T people. And so this is an intriguing area. And hopefully in the next 6 to 12 months, we'll have that data out in the literature.
So what do you think the best way is for us, as this research is quickly evolving, to meet our oncologists somewhere in the middle? Because oftentimes we are not at the oncology conferences. I mean, rarely are we in the same room.
Yeah. So first of all, I think oncologists are generally very data driven. And I think we need data. Mm-hmm. And I think you've heard me say this before, you know, the concept of EBM, right? You know, evidence-based medicine. Well, that's also eminence-based medicine. right? So somebody famous stands up and says something. So we can't be doing that with the oncologists, right? And then the smallest EBM is enthusiasm-based medicine, where if you just say it loudly enough, long enough, people are going to start believing you, right? So we need true level one, ideally, evidence-based medicine. I don't know that a randomized control trial is actually ethically appropriate when we know that low T is potentially very dangerous to people, right? Bone sugar, heart concept. So I think we need data. We need good, well-done observational studies, and without getting into the weeds, that account for a mortal time bias, which our data that was published in Journal of Urology in January of this year does, but most series before that didn't. That's a very important methodologic flaw in observational studies. So
what do you mean by that?
So mortal time bias is the idea that you take men who you're following. It's an observational study where you're giving men T, right? But they're so you give them T, and obviously they have an undetectable PSA. And there's a group of men who you're not giving T to, right? Immortal time bias means the time from the prostatectomy, let's say, up until the time they get T, right? They're believed to be, the concept is they're immortal, right? So you have to exclude that 14 months post-prostatectomy before they got T, right, from the equation. And, you know, most data and Tom Ehlering's data just never accounted for that. I'm not impugning the quality of their data analysis, but never accounted for that. That is massively important that you account for that in observational studies in the post prostate cancer TT therapy space. Okay. So our January paper did that, and any paper going forward hopefully will account for that. But I think we need those kind of studies to really go head-to-head with our prostatectomies and our radongs and medongs and have an honest discussion. And so I did a debate at the EAU a couple of years ago, and it was a chap with Gleason 6 cancer, had a radical prostatectomy. He was 60 years of age, and he's very low T. And I made the point, and I think very reasonably so based on science, that that man is more likely to die of his low T than he would his prostate cancer recurrence. Gleason 6, prostatectomy, undetectable PSA, the bone sugar heart issues over a 20-25 year period, if that man survived that long, with low T. So I think having these conversations, and it's a war of attrition. For sure it's a war of attrition. We're not going to convince all of them immediately. But I think ongoing, honest, science-based discussions are really what we need to do. But we need a forum, right? And so, you know, we need to get on ASCO, and we need to have FaceTime at GU ASCO. We need to get FaceTime at SUO. And increasingly, the younger oncologists are allowing us to do that. So I think it's only a matter of time before there's going to be a very large shift in how we approach this.
Mm-hmm. So maybe an initial step for what we can do in sexual medicine, if we're trying to change practice in other fields within urology, is we need to show up to their meetings.
Yeah, not like we don't have enough meetings to get to. But I do think we do
need grand rounds.
We do need FaceTime.
Yeah.
And, you know, listen, I've been at Memorial Sloan Kettering for 22 years. And I don't want anyone to think that within 6 months of me getting there, everyone was on board. You know, I was there when Peter Scardino was the chair of urology and the chair of surgery. And he was very friendly to the concepts. And over the course of time, we built up this incredible experience in this exact space. So it does take time. Okay. And I think we need to be collaborative. And I think that we need to present good science to our oncology colleagues.
Love that. All right. So let's say it's a Wednesday morning and I'm walking into your clinic and you're seeing a guy who has concerns for low testosterone. What are your go-to formulations? If we look at the AUA guidelines, there's a beautiful chart in the guidelines with all the formulations and the doses and the frequencies. I think some people look at it. I know I did. I looked at it and I said, I feel like I'm going to kill my patient with testosterone. I don't know where to begin. Where do you begin?
Yeah. So first of all, we published the testosterone therapy checklist a few years ago. And I love this. And I would encourage anyone, Flores, Jose Flores is the first author, JSM, go print it out as a PDF and hang it up in your clinic, right? So what are patients wanting? They want good T levels, but there's a cost issue and there's a preference issue. You know, some people say, I'm not sticking a needle in my butt or my thigh. And you know, some patients say, well, why would I use drug X that has an 80% chance of success when I can use a shot and it's 100%, right? So cost and preference. And then two other very, very important concepts, transference you're going to get yourself hurt as a urologist or a nurse practitioner in the space or a PA if you're prescribing tea and you do not document that you had a transference conversation with the patient. So the concept of transdermal agents getting transferred to a pregnant woman or a prepubertal child. Famous cases in this country of grandfathers, caretakers to 6 and 8 year old granddaughters, and the granddaughters go through puberty at that age. Devastation, right? So we must have that conversation. And I now routinely do not give patients transdermal tea if they're high risk of transference. A 35-year-old man, post-orchiectomy, post-4 cycles of DP, he's got a 2 and a 3 year old daughter at home. I don't give them transdermal gels. No matter how vigilant the patient may think they're going to be about washing their hands, etc., I think it's such high risk, I avoid that. Okay? The second then, of course, is fertility interest, right? And we have a hard conversation irrespective of the patient's age. I mean, Manhattan, we've got lots of 7-year-olds, we've got 35.
Yeah, that's my patient population too. I don't make assumptions.
So we don't make assumptions and we ask everyone about their interest in fertility. And if they say, I'm not sure, or maybe I might be interested, we do not give them exogenous tea if we can avoid it. And they're the groups who get alternatives such as SERMs, clomiphene or enclomiphene, aromatase inhibitors if they have high E2 levels at baseline, or HCG. Okay, so they're two very important questions. Based on that information, cost, preference, fertility, and transference, we have a list. Every testosterone product you can imagine, we give the patient the list and we say, go check with your insurance coverage what's covered. And then they come back to us, yes, I want to do tea, here's what's covered, and we have that conversation with the patient. So it's very patient-driven in my practice. If you have somebody, however, who's had a bilateral orchiectomy, a synchronous bilateral orc, or a metachronous completion orchiectomy for recurrent testis cancer, those patients tend to do very poorly with transdermal tea. Because now you're looking, our definition of success in our practice is a end of treatment tea level above 400 with a 200 point improvement. So it's a composite definition, right? It's not just getting them above 400. They started at 350 and they went to 400. That's not much of a success, right? If they start at 150 and they go to 300, that's not much of a success. So we're looking for a 200 point improvement and getting them at least over 400, okay? And that's ultimately our goal. And then we check symptoms at baseline. We check symptoms in the long term, signs at baseline, signs in follow-up, et cetera.
How did you come up with the 200 improvement?
Out of the air. Okay.
So the I love when experts just say that.
But there's no one's ever validated that as an endpoint. But
yeah.
I'm a very rational physician. And from a rational standpoint, okay, the AUA says middle tertile of the range. We can agree or disagree about that, but we want people in above 400, above 450, right? So over 400. But if we have patients who are 350 at baseline, and we got many patients who are 350 who are very symptomatic or have signs of low T, and we're going to treat those guys going to 410 with a 60-point improvement, surely that's not good T therapy. So that's why I'm looking for a good two. Maybe it's 150, maybe it's 250. But I use 200 and ending up over 400. And that's when I believe somebody is responding to T therapy, whether it is exogenous or whether it is an alternative strategy.
So on the topic of topicals, when I started off at the University of Iowa, like admittedly, I didn't have much expertise in hormone health. Like many urologists, we are trained as surgeons. We don't want to talk to patients. We want a scalpel in our hands in the operating room, right? And so, but because I was now considered like the expert in low T, I said, well, I'm going to go where they tell me not to go. I'm going to go online. I'm going to go on Facebook and I'm going to join a closed testosterone replacement therapy support group because I need to learn what will take me an entire career to learn very quickly in terms of the experience of real people around the world. And I saw from all these posts that people tended not to like topicals and they did better with injectables. So is there a patient that shows up to your clinic where you have found that they do well with topicals?
Well, listen, topicals work probably if you look at serum T levels. We're not talking about symptom improvement, right? So you get men who get great serum levels of T and the symptoms don't improve. And the presumption is that the symptoms weren't due to your low T. You got low T for sure, but your symptoms are due to other things, right? All those symptoms, chronic depression, stress, OSA, et cetera, right? So 80% chance that a man on a gel is going to have physiologic T levels when they use a gel, if they're using it properly, right? Whether it's Androgel or Testum or Vogelex or Fertesta, whatever, it's about 80%. So it's 20% who don't do well based on skin chemistry and absorption, right? So I think it's a viable option for some people, okay? There are lots of people, it's personality driven, who it's messy and I don't like it, it's daily, right? The advantage of the intramuscular tea, of course, is that, or sub-Q, if you're using things like Xiostead, or Mokera's approach of using T-cypionate twice a week subcutaneously, right? The advantage of that is that it's infrequent, but there's some people who are needle phobic and don't want to do it. This is why I'm very focused on patient preference. I say, sure, decision-making. You decide what it is that you want to try. I tell patients that if you're going an exogenous tea, they're essentially interchangeable. Gel, pills, subcutaneous, intramuscular. You can go from one to the other and go back to the other if you don't like. You go from A to B and then you go back to A. But if you want to use an alternative strategy like clomiphene and clomiphene or HCG, you don't want to start with an exogenous tea because you're going to suppress the HPG axis. And if you're on exogenous tea for long enough, pick a number, 12 months or longer, maybe the HPG axis is not going to rebound to the level that it would have. And maybe your response to clomiphene won't be as good. So I like to use, if somebody has a low to low normal LH, which is the group of patients that we use clomiphene or N-clomiphene in, I like to use that as an upfront strategy if they've any interest in that. Okay? I'm a big fan of clomiphene. We've published many papers on clomiphene in the literature. And if you take men who are selected low to low normal LH, they have a 70% chance of having a good serum response. There are clearly men who do not get good symptomatic improvement with clomiphene. And without getting into the weeds again, of course, clomiphene is a combination of N-clomiphene and zooclomiphene. And zooclomiphene is a bad actor, right? So that's what causes high estrogen levels and that what probably causes stunts the symptomatic response. So we're really shifting over to N-clomiphene, albeit, in full disclosure, it is not FDA approved in the United States of America and it's a compounded drug. But there were trials done that show it's a very effective medication. The reason not FDA approved at this point in time is complicated. Okay. It's not related to efficacy. Okay. So we're using a lot of N-clomiphene and we're seeing very good responses to N-clomiphene in men with low to low normal LH. Now you might say to me, well, what about a guy with an LH of 14? If his pituitary is already flogging his testis by producing 14 international units per ml of LH, how is N-clomiphene going to help? It's not. And that's why we really focus on those men with LH levels below 6. And that's our index patient for a SERM. And I'm a big fan of that. You'll have endocrinologists. I sometimes say you got 6 people on a panel and you're going to get 12 opinions, right? So we get endocrinologists that, oh, you shouldn't keep people on a SERM for long because it interferes with bone density. We published 3-year data showing there's no interference with bone density. And our 5-year data that we're looking at the moment looks very clean. What we do check in patients who are on chronic clomiphene or N-clomiphene, we do check bone density every couple of years just to make sure that it's okay.
What about lipid panels on patients on SERMs?
Yeah, you know, so there is, I have some colleagues who've come to me saying, we have a couple of patients with serious hypertriglyceridemia in response to clomiphene. We are looking at that, and I have to tell you, we haven't seen that yet. And we've got a big clomiphene practice. So I think the answer to that question is stay tuned. I do not routinely check lipid profiles. That's a historical entity coming from oral methyl testosterone and hepatic problems, right? The new oral agents, of course, testosterone, undecanoate are absorbed lymphatically, right? And bypass hepatic metabolism. So there's no hepatic concerns. But no, I don't check the lipids. We now do check, of course, BP. Okay, although the mean change in BP is, 3 millimeters of mercury systolic, but that now is firmly in the label for all testosterone products. And that most probably is related to the mineralocorticoid effect, particularly of intramuscular tea. And those patients who have the highest blood pressure changes are those who have known hypertension who are on antihypertensives. So the non-hypertensive patients, we tend not to see those changes at all. But I think it's very reasonable when you're following your patients up that you check a BP if they're on TTH.
So 3 millimeters of mercury, that wouldn't even show up as a blip on my radar if I saw that on a blood pressure.
No.
That seems so insignificant. And yet it is like statistically significant.
But if you speak to a cardiologist, they'll say to you, if he has that blood pressure change for 20 years, he'll get left ventricular hypertrophy, blah, blah, blah. So over a long period of time, it can be consequential. And if somebody has a significant blood pressure change, which is very rare in our testosterone space, go see your PCP or go see your cardiologist and have them opine in that area. I'm a penis doctor, Mr. Jones, right? So yeah, but we do check the BPs, but we don't check lipids at this point in time. We are checking in the clomiphene group. Stay tuned for that data. Hopefully we'll have that over the next 6 to 12 months.
Yeah. All right. Going back real quick to the Clomid and clomiphene discussion. So now if you see a new patient, you're going to start them on a SERM. Are you trialing them first on clomiphene or are you just going right to enclomiphene?
So it's a cost issue, right? Mm-hmm. So enclomiphene is 2 to 3 times more expensive than clomiphene. It's about $1.50 a day, right? Some patients just don't want to withstand that cost, so they'll just use clomiphene. So again, patient preference, I leave that up to them. The critical thing when you people on a SERM is that you want to, based on LH, I would say that's low to low normal, but you want to monitor their LH, right? So you'll have men whose T level doesn't improve on clomiphene or enclomiphene. I'll use them interchangeably, right? So I'll just say clomiphene. You have men whose T levels doesn't change, but their LH went from 2 to 8. Their pituitary is responsive, but their testis is not. They have responded to clomiphene and they failed. You know, from a T level, they need to move on to another form of therapy. Different from the man, we use 25 milligrams of clomiphene every other day, okay? Half of 50 milligram every other day. N-clomiphene is 25 milligrams daily to start with, okay? We check the LH goes from 2 to 2.5. That's a dosing issue. Now we will change the dose of clomiphene, right? We want to see people get a good LH bounce before we decide whether they failed clomiphene or not. There are some people who don't get a good LH bounce and they fail clomiphene, right? But so it's very important that you're checking the LH, and everyone on clomiphene, less so N-clomiphene, but everyone on clomiphene should have an estradiol level measured, because there is an incidence of hyperestrogenemia when patients, because of the zuclomiphene effect. So everyone should get their estrogen level checked.
I've seen patients quite often in my clinic that are initially managed by another provider, and then they see me for, let's say, a second opinion, and they're on testosterone cypionate and clomiphene or enclomiphene.
Yeah.
I cannot wrap my mind around how that would work.
Yeah. Technically, it does make sense in the sense that we used testosterone and HCG together, right, for fertility preservation.
But that makes sense. I get that.
Yeah. Because you're giving those men, you're giving them LH, right? So you're giving them T and you're giving them LH. The problem with testosterone and clomiphene, and this is frequently in my practice, comes from anti-aging low T centers, right? Is that when you put somebody on exogenous testosterone, you're suppressing the HPG axis. And so giving somebody clomiphene, which is supposed to boost LH, and I don't know if there's any good literature that says how effective is clomiphene in this group when they're on exogenous T, but theoretically, it's a problem because you're suppressing the HPG axis. Then how can clomiphene work to the level that would work if they were on clomiphene monotherapy? Okay, there's no way it works to the same degree as it does with monotherapy, right? So I think if you're going to do that strategy, and there are some patients who are potential candidates for that, I would be using HCG rather than clomiphene.
Now, you made a comment that if someone is on testosterone and their levels go up, let's say 500, 600, and symptomatically they don't feel better, then we say, okay, your symptoms were not due to low testosterone. But could it be the formulation of testosterone where they might respond better to another formulation?
I don't think so. I think that the serum levels drive symptom improvement if the symptoms were due to low T. I thought the question you were going to ask me is, well, what happens if that patient who's got a T level of 250 now had a T level of 900, right? And we're getting them in the middle tertile of the range. And by the way, I chair the AUA guidelines, right? And we chose the middle tertile of the range, expert opinion, because we wanted to make sure that those men who had lived in the lower tertile of the range prior to testosterone therapy, right? Normally, the physiologic set point was in the lower tertile, were not being overtreated. And we weren't going to undertreat dramatically men who were in the highest tertile of the range, right? That's why we agreed on the middle tertile, right? But there are men we know who are 900 at baseline and who end up at 250. Is putting them at the 500, 600 range appropriate? I think it's a good start. I think it's a judgment call, right? Remember, guidelines, it's not a biblical dictum. You decide, use your clinical judgment to decide whether you're going to move up or not. But there is no good evidence, and you saw this presentation at SMASNA last year, that supraphysiologic levels of T are important for anything other than musculoskeletal changes. So muscle building, potentially, right? So I'm not a fan of putting people into supraphysiologic range, okay? But I think if you have somebody whose level is 500 and they're still symptomatic, the question in front of you is that because their symptoms were not due to low T, or is it that their T levels are not at the level that they need to be? Of course, we don't have T levels on men, you know, from when they were 30, they come in at 65, and you know what their T level was when they were 30. I'm a big fan, I'm sure I'll take some abuse for this, from a cost standpoint. I think every man who's 40 years of age should get an early morning total T level done using LCMS. All right. So when you come and see me at 65 years of age, I have a sense for where you were when you were, you know, younger. Okay. So we don't have that in most men. And that's a judgment call that a, you know, clinician, you use your experience and your expertise to make a decision.
We always worry about costs, but it's, and that it's definitely a worry that we should have, right? But it is so rare, if ever, that I've had a patient, I checked their testosterone and it's not covered by insurance.
Their blood test, you mean?
Their blood test.
Yeah. I mean, we don't hear that, although Memorial, so, you know, it's a slightly unique environment from an insurance standpoint. So I don't know the answer to that in regular practice. I don't know if there'll be pushback about using equilibrium analysis routinely, for example, which is more expensive for sure.
But I've never seen that. I've never seen an issue. And like, I would be the first to know. The provider would be the first to know because our patients would complain to us. I've heard them complain about other things.
No doubt. No doubt. Yeah. The other thing I think that we should touch on today is the concept, and when we spoke at AUA, we kind of briefly alluded to this, is the concept of obstructive sleep apnea in the low testosterone patient. So remember that testosterone induces erythropoiesis. And technically, unexplained anemia is one of the indications for checking T. And by the way, we got a bunch of people in our practice who are from our medical oncologist, hematology, lymphoma, leukemia, et cetera, who have chronically low hemoglobin, who we put on T even with kind of low or borderline or, you know, in the 300 to 400 range. We put them on T, right? So low T should induce anemia. So if you have a man who comes in to see you with a low T, let's say below 250, and his hematocrit is 48%. How is that possible? And by far and away, the most common scenario that causes that, those men have obstructive sleep apnea. So all of our patients who are going on T in our practice complete the stop-band questionnaire. And if it's medium to high risk, we suggest they get an APSAT, a home sleep apnea test. And if their crit is at baseline 45% or higher, we insist on them getting an HSAT. Because the mean change in hematocrit when we put men on T, going from testosterone deficiency to eugenol status, is 6%. So if you start at 46, you're going into that kind of danger zone, 52%. So keep an eye on those men with very low T and check their crit based on which we're all supposed to do, because if it's 50% or above, we're not supposed to do anything. They're supposed to see a hematologist, screen them for OSA. Because low T should be associated with low normal or low hematocrit.
Hmm. I've never heard anyone verbalize that before, but that makes perfect sense. So that's going to be another clip for social. My last question here, what if someone will not get tested for sleep apnea because they say there's no way that I'm going to wear a CPAP?
Yeah, that's not uncommon statement in my practice. I think that if they have low T and their crit is below 45%, and we can keep them below, we use 50%. I'm very conservative, right? 54% of the guidelines, many people are using 52%. I don't want to get involved in having to coordinate phlebotomy. My practice is too busy. That's very burdensome. It comes with significant responsibilities. So I want to keep people below 50. So if they start below 45 with a mean change in hematocrit of 5 to 6%, I'm okay with that. I'll tell them, I think you should have an HSAT because sleep apnea is not just you keep your partner awake because you snore, associated with hypertension, atrial fibrillation, congestive heart failure, and accumulating evidence that suggests it's associated with dementia, right? So it's a public health issue, so we encourage them. But if they're 45% or above, I will not give those patients T without an HSAT. right? We have a very famous case in our practice where the man was on ADT and he had castrate T levels and his hematocrit was 48%. Saw a hematologist, completely negative, OSA. And we pick up OSA all the time. In fact, when we give the stop bang to our patients who are T therapy candidates, two-thirds of them have an abnormal, have medium to high risk OSA, and two-thirds of them have an abnormal HSAT, right? So, you know, listen, 30% of men over 50 years of age have obstructive sleep apnea. So, you know, it's not that it's uncommon. And we're seeing this high prevalence in our low T population because they have metabolic syndrome, they put on weight, they got big necks, blah, 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 blah. So they're at increased risk for OSA for sure. Okay, we don't need to manage their OSA. I don't want to be involved in that. But I think we have a responsibility as a men's health expert to say, listen, you've got obstructive sleep apnea. Until proven otherwise, you need to speak to your PCP about this or see a sleep physician.
Yeah, I like that last comment you made because essentially everyone has sleep apnea until proven otherwise.
Yeah, but listen, if you're a male over 50 years of age and you've got a neck size of 17 or greater and a BMI of 35, you've got four of the eight thing on the stop bang, you've got medium risk for having obstructive sleep apnea.
Yeah, facts, hashtag facts. So before we started recording today, you said, wow, your outline is pretty extensive. I doubt we're going to get through it. And we did not get through it. So I'm just going to have you back on our podcast.
My honor and pleasure. And I hope this goes well.
Thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Cheers, Amy. Bye.